hidden meanings. When you're in a conversation or a discussion with someone or in a negotiation and someone says, in my humble opinion, man, get ready. They're about to unload a truck full of ego on you. You see, the words, in my humble opinion, are a disclaimer that they're going to unload everything on you. If you're in a negotiation and someone says, oh, don't worry about it, we'll work out the details later, that means you're not even close. You have got to work the details out up front. It's the details that can kill a deal. Go for the details up front. That makes the bigger picture much easier, and it's easy to use the details as that little nibbling stuff we just spoke about. It doesn't make a difference if it's a handshake deal, and especially in a contractual agreement. You're not going to work out those details later on. They've got to be specified right now, line item by line item. If you've ever uttered the words, with all due respect, you know that means you have absolutely no respect for the person you're talking with. Well, when you hear those words, that person has no respect for you either. Just be aware. Someone says, I haven't given this much thought, but that means they've been thinking about nothing else for the past week. This is a well-orchestrated strategy. If someone says, don't worry, you had better start worrying. If you're a parent and you've ever had one of the kids call you in the middle of the night at 3 o'clock in the morning, the phone rings, you answer it, and you hear your child's voice say, it's okay, there's been a little accident, but don't worry, I've got it under control. And then they go on to explain it to you. You take that initial deep breath and you know, you better start worrying. Many years ago, when I returned to my office, there was a message to call my father. I did. He said, Richard, there was a little fire at the house, but don't worry. How about if you go make sure your mother is okay? I said, all right. I told my manager I'd be gone for a while, which turned out to be a week, and I left. As I'm heading to the house on the freeway, I remembered my father said he'd meet me there. I realized he owns his own business, and he was the only one in the business. He said he's coming to the house. He was 45 minutes away. So the words, don't worry, got amplified for me. As I was screaming up the freeway, I was waiting for a cop to stop and ask me, where's the fire? And I was going to tell him. Well, what happened was, I had this vision of the fire trucks lining the street and that house engulfed in flames. And I said to myself, nah, that's not what's happening. As I came into the neighborhood and I got around the corner, that's exactly what was happening. It started with, don't worry. Now, the ending was fine. Everyone was fine. Other than shock, everyone was okay. The house was rebuilt. The lesson here is about the words, don't worry. And knowing that when you hear that, you better start worrying. Remember, hidden meanings. In the next segment, I'll talk about matchmaking. Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. I'm not talking about personal ads or dating sites or setting up people in relationships. I'm talking about matching and mismatching. Our brains are wired, well, in many different ways, but in this specific reference in one of two ways, either to see similarities or to see differences. We see matches or mismatches. If someone looks at a crowd of people, some people will say, there's people. Some people will say, there are some men, there are some women, and there are some children. Some will say, there are 5 men, 7 women, and 4 children. It's just the way our minds are wired. It's not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It's just the way you happen to be. If you're dealing with a matcher, or if you are a matcher, you will see similarities in things. You're the person who would look at that group and say, oh, there are people. You may, when approaching a deal, say, this is exactly like the last deal I was in. And again, you will use visual, auditory, or kinesthetic language. This looks very similar to that last one, or that sounds exactly the same as the last one I listened to, or this feels so familiar. This piece of art looks exactly like the last one I bought. I don't know why you'd want to buy another one. It looks just like the other one. The mismatcher is going to say, wow, this is so different from the other item. Your responsibility as the expert in communication is to know where the person lives. Recognize their language. Recognize their language and feed it back to them. Feed it back to them so they have a connection with you. So if they're using words that allow you to recognize they are comparing as distinct from contrasting, you're going to amplify the similarities, pointing out the things that are the same. as the excellent negotiator, as the master communicator, and they're looking at a car and they say, wow, this is just like the last car I had. I really like that. Well, you are now going to ask them all about their last car, and you're going to ask them what they liked about it, and you're going to point out the similarities between the last one and the one they're looking at. They're buying a piece of art, and they've told you, I like this style. It's so much like everything else I bought. And you say something like, tell me about the art you have. Now you can find the similarities and amplify them. Is it oil? Is it watercolor? Is it a giclée? What is the media? Is it a sculpture? Blown glass? Contemporary? Impressionistic? Maybe it's the artist they like. If they say, this is so different from anything else I have, find out what they have and amplify the differences. Then there are some people who are called polarized mismatchers. These are people who, if they see you doing something different, out of the ordinary, separate from everyone else, something you shouldn't be doing perhaps, they're going to point it out to you. Now, if you happen to be in law enforcement, that's who you are. Whether it's by nature or nurture, nature or training, I don't know. But a polarized mismatcher is going to see something out of the ordinary. They're going to see the car speeding on the freeway or on the surface street, and they're going to point it out to you that you've been exceeding the speed limit. They're going to find you and let you know. One New Year's Eve, I was returning home. I was about a half a mile from where I lived. I saw the police car on the corner. I saw him pull up behind me, and I said to the woman I was with, he's going to pull me over. Sure enough, he flashed his lights, and I just pulled over. He walked over to me, over to the car. He was very polite. Most police officers are very polite. They recognize that people may be nervous, and they're going to do their best, most of them, to put you at ease. So this officer walks over to the car and asks for my license and registration. I suspect if you are like most people, when a policeman pulls you over or a policewoman pulls you over and walks over to the car, the first thing you're going to say is, what did I do wrong? Or something like that. Remember, we've defined that law enforcement officers are generally mismatchers. So you've just fallen into their model of mismatching. What did I do wrong? The presumption is you did something wrong. I handed him my license and registration. I didn't say a word. I might have said good evening. He asked, do you know how fast you were going back there? I looked at him and I honestly said, no, officer, I don't. He said, you were doing 45 in a 35 zone. Most of us are going to disagree. No, I wasn't. If you do that, you're stuck right in the middle of his model of mismatching. I looked up at him and said, really? I was doing 45? Wow, that's dumb. What I just did was shift from his mismatching model into matching him. I agreed with him. They're not used to that. I looked at him and watched his brain trying to figure this one out. I said something like, I live right around the corner. I know the speed limits. I can't believe I was speeding. I'm watching him try and figure out what's going on. His mind couldn't get the fact that I was matching him. I was agreeing with him instead of being argumentative or mismatching with him. I was firm. I was in my power. I was just acknowledging. He asked, do you live around here? Remember, I just told him I live right around the corner. At the time, my registration showed my office address some 25 miles away, but I was around the corner from where I live. He said, but your registration, I said, I know. The registration is through my office, but I live right here. He asked me again if I lived right here. I said, yeah, right around the corner. He's trying to figure out what's going on. And again, I said, I just can't believe I was doing it. I can't believe I was speeding. He stood as in deep thought for a while and then handed me my license and registration and said, please drive safely. As he walked back to his car, I rolled up my window. I yelled, yes! Now, I'm not telling you this is going to work every time. I'm simply using this as an example of the power of matching and mismatching, understanding the distinctions and how to be in rapport with someone. To build better rapport with people, learn if they're matches or mismatches and meet them on their own terms. If you're speaking to a matcher and you show them differences, the level of communication, the level of rapport goes down dramatically. If you speak to a mismatcher and show them similarities, well, the same thing happens. Rapport just evaporates. Mismatchers, for example, make great editors. They can look at a document or a page and immediately see the comma that is outside the quotation mark instead of inside. They'll see the misspelled word. These things really pop out to mismatchers. In a global picture, for example, a mismatcher would see different races, different cultures, different religions. A matcher would simply see people. Just remember, whether you are a matcher or a mismatcher, you find the person you're dealing with and you match them or you mismatch them, knowing where they are, and you will build a higher, a deeper level of rapport. In the next segment, I'll discuss why Gutenberg was right. Gutenberg was right. Great. Who is Gutenberg? He was the first one who made movable type, and the first printed item was the Bible. And that was a few years back, back in 1451. The point here is put it in writing. Most people are highly visual. They believe the things they see. Certainly, you've heard the expression, seeing is believing. Earlier, I spoke about Alan Funt and Candid Camera. There are two other episodes from that show that fit perfectly into what I'm talking about here, as far as being visual, people believing what they see. Alan Funt and his crew put one of those road barriers in front of a tributary road going into the state of Delaware. Funt had his car parked a few feet from the barricade. The sign on the barricade said, "Delaware closed." People would come up, pull up behind his car and ask, "What's going on?" He wouldn't say a thing. He would point to the sign, and the sign said, "Delaware closed." People believe what they read. They'd ask him, "What do you mean Delaware's closed? How long will it stay closed?" Funt would just put his arms up, shrug his shoulders, never said a word, and point to the sign. As other people came up, those in the front of the line would now tell everyone else, the newcomers, "Delaware's closed. Can you believe this? They closed Delaware." After some length of time, Funt walked over to the barrier, picked it up, folded it up, put it in the trunk of his car, and it was like the Indy 500, "Drivers, start your engines." People ran to their cars and raced into Delaware. They believe what they read. And so do you, and so do I. And there was another episode, this one in downtown Manhattan, actually on Wall Street. Now, if you've ever been to Wall Street, to say it's crowded at lunchtime would be an understatement. If you take a deep breath, four other people have to move out of the way just to make room. There are so many people milling around trying to get to lunch before they have to get back to work. Back in those days, they had telephone booths. This was decades before the cell phone. A telephone booth was an enclosure you went into to use the payphone, unless you were Superman, and then you went in to change. You actually closed the door behind you. On one booth, it said men, the other said women. There was a Candid Camera actor in the women's booth and one in the men's booth. While there was a line in front of the men's booth, there was no line in front of the women's. The first person or two in the men's line were also Candid Camera actors. Soon, others got in line. Eventually, the woman got out of the women's booth. Men continued to get in the men's line. One of the actors began nervously glancing at his watch. To the guy in front of him, not an actor, just a civilian, he said, "Gee, I really have to make an important call. Do you think anyone would mind if I use the woman's booth?" The guy in front of him, and remember, this is not an actor, said, "I don't think they would have put the sign up if it didn't matter." The nervous caller, the actor, shrugged his shoulders and got back in line. All this time, there's an empty phone booth next to them. People believe what they read. The civilians in line just stood there. Years ago, the lady I was traveling with and I stopped at a restaurant to use the bathrooms. We went to the back, and there was a bathroom with a sign that said men and one that said women. Well, there's a lady standing in front of the women's room waiting, and the men's room was empty. I went into the men's room, and when I came out, the lady I was with went into the men's room. I simply stood there waiting for her. You realize it doesn't make a difference which bathroom. The only difference in the men's room is usually there's a urinal, and sometimes not even that. When she came out, the other lady was still standing in front of the woman's room waiting for the woman to exit. She looked at us, looked at the men's room, looked at the sign that said men, and went back to standing. She was waiting. We hung out for a few minutes just out of curiosity to see if that lady was going to go into the men's room, and of course she didn't, because it said men. People believe what they read. Now, please, I'm certainly not suggesting you do this in public bathrooms where there can be more than one person in there at a time, unless you have someone to guard the door. Use discretion, please. In years gone by, it was difficult for hotels to get people to check out of their room on time. Holiday Inn was the first chain of hotels to put a sign on the back of the door with a checkout time. They were instrumental in the total transformation of the hospitality industry for getting people to check out when they're supposed to. Hospitality data now shows some 90% of people will actually check out on time simply because of the sign on the back of the door that tells you the checkout time. Now, of course, you can call the front desk and get an extended checkout, but most people never do because the sign says checkout is at noon or 1, and people believe it, and they're out of the room by then. People believe what they read. So what is this all about? It's about put it in writing. Again, put it in writing, whatever it is, put it in writing. It doesn't make a difference what the fee or item is. Put it in writing. If you're selling something, if you're having a sale and people come and make you offers, if it's not in writing, and the prices that is, you'll spend all day negotiating. Put tags on items, put labels on items. Now, it doesn't prevent the negotiation or the inquiry, but you can simply point and say, that's the price, just as Alan Funt did. He pointed to the sign. Most people say, oh, okay. You and I have both been to myriad sales on both sides, buying and selling. When there's a price tag on it, most people simply pay it. You now have new strategies, new skills, new concepts for dealing with things, even when they do have a price tag. If you're a professional, put your fees for services in writing. While there are some exceptions, almost every restaurant has the price for every item printed on the menu. It's in writing. Imagine trying to book a flight or rent a car without the fees being published. When you go to buy a new car, the cars always have a sticker on it, the price sticker, and that's why they call it vehicle sticker shock. But they have the sticker on it. It's in writing. It's very official looking and meant to have you believe that that really is the price for the car. And of course, each option is lined out with a price. And you know there's ample room to negotiate. And again, you have strategies to do exactly that. And there are additional reasons to put things in writing. If you have an office and people responsible for certain activities and tasks, it is prudent to have an office manual with procedures and policies to define the duties and responsibilities clearly for every person. Many years ago, I fired a young lady who listed my office phone number as contact information, with my address, by the way, for 2 ads she placed in the newspaper. One was for her motorcycle that she was selling. The second, she was seeking an eclectic partner. How curious. I soon got a phone call from the Unemployment Insurance Department of the state. She filed for unemployment insurance because she got fired. The lady I spoke with, while she empathized with my situation, she told me that since it was not explicitly forbidden for employees to use the office phone number and address for personal reasons, I might be liable for her compensation. How distressing. It wasn't in writing. Needless to say, that day I started to write my office policies and procedures manual. If you don't have such a statement, I encourage you to immediately add it to your policy manual. And if you don't have a policy manual, this is a good time to start creating one. Fortunately, there were other extenuating circumstances that prohibited this lady from collecting unemployment insurance benefits. Hey, put it in writing. Imagine trying to buy or lease a house or a car or have a loan from a bank or an investment from an investor without a written contract. I go over it again and again so that you can really anchor it. Many, many years ago, I gave someone a significant amount of money. I wrote them a check to prevent their condo from going into foreclosure. Foolish at the time, there was nothing in writing. Well, I'll tell you, I never got my money back. There was no contract. I had no recourse. Put it in writing. If you have young children and they're old enough to read and understand, you might consider written agreements with them about such things as homework, playtime, etc. Rather than ask them to remember what you guys agreed upon, it's easier and more effective and more efficient to have a written agreement with both of your signatures on it. I did that with my son when he was very young. If you accomplish this, you're entitled to that. If you do this, you can have that. There was very little negotiating or arguing when he was shown the written agreement. It was, oh, did I do that? If you make a loan to someone, or someone loans money to you, or you make an investment, or someone invests in you, put all the details in writing. I told you how I got burned with a significant amount of money because I had nothing in writing. Include the amount of the loan or the investment, the interest rate, terms, etc. And understand, writings and contracts are only as good as the person behind the signature, but at least you have a starting point. As I'm preparing this segment, a physician friend of mine related a story. She purchased specialized computer software for her practice. She was told the software would do certain things. Well, after she paid for it and it was installed, she discovered the modules she was promised were not even part of the program. The salesperson, much to no one's surprise, was no longer with the company, and of course, there was no documentation as to the verbal assurances. So I say it again, get it in writing. And when it comes to contracts, in another segment I'll discuss who writes the contract. So remember, Gutenberg was right. Put it in writing. In the next segment, I'm going to discuss thinking about it. I've got to think about it. Very interesting words. And you've used these words before, and I assure you, they've been used on you. When you're in a situation of making a buying decision, and let's talk about bigger ticket items like houses and cars or high-end computers or televisions, high-end entertainment centers. I mean, we're not generally talking about $10, $20 items here, although the principle is the same. And again, you've said it, and it's been said to you. I'll have to think about it. In most situations, I'll have to think about it means, where's the nearest emergency exit? I'm out of here. Whether you're buying or selling, it means you'll never see that person again, generally. The counter to that, if you are selling something and someone says, I'll have to think about it, the counter is, great, I'm glad you're even considering it. But my experience is, I've got to think about it can mean several different things. It can mean you want to say no. And here's what, if you want to say no, please tell me now. Let's not leave this hanging out there. If you need to say no, it's okay. It's not the answer I want, not the one I would choose, but it is an answer, and accept it. Just let me know. And of course, you've got so much more information from this system and so much more yet to come that you have the skills and ability to come back to them with other answers and solutions that you just may be able to convert that no into a yes. The second thing you say, it can also mean you really do want to think about it. If that's so, that's great. Just let me know that too. If you really do need to think about it, when might you be able to make that decision? Can I call you by noon tomorrow? Silence. You've heard that a lot about that. What you want here is a commitment from that person as to when they will have thought about it and when you can have the next conversation. Because, you know, if they just walk out and say, I'll get back to you, you can close your book on that person. While it's possible they will get back to you, the odds are very much against it. Let's say you're talking with a potential investor and they tell you they've got to think about it. Great, I'm so glad. Can I call you by noon tomorrow? Silence. You wait for them to respond. They thought they may be out of the deal. They can walk away and be done. Well, I need a couple of days. Great, how does Monday at noon work? And yet there's another part. You say, I've got to think about it can also mean something else. It can mean I haven't explained all the details. So let me make certain I've covered everything. If you are in a position to make a short-term bridge loan of $5,000, I'm going to guarantee it against equipment as well as the company. We're going to have the contract signed and notarized. I'm going to be paying you interest like clockwork at the beginning of the month. And at the end of the rental period, I'm renting your money for a year, I'm going to give you a cashier's check for the principal. If I've omitted any of these things before, I hope I've covered them now. So how do you feel about being that investor for me? And by now you know, silence. Well, what did I just do? To all intents and purposes, I've just gone through the details without the story around it. I've given them the facts, just the facts. So now they're in a new decision place, and they may say, yep, that sounds all well and good, and I've still got to think about it. You go back to broken record. Great, can I call you tomorrow? Or again, you say, if you need to say no, please say it now. Just remember how to respond to, "I've got to think about it." In the next segment, we'll talk about hot potatoes. Hot potatoes. This is not the kind of potato you're having at the family barbecue. This is about checking for validity. It shows up in myriad ways, and it classically shows up where someone will take their problem or their perceived problems and attempt to put them over to you so you can have empathy or sympathy or just let them out of whatever conversation or negotiation you're in. It's also a way of avoiding the responsibility of making a decision. Part of this actually deals with deferring to higher authority. So someone may say, for example, "I might be willing to buy this house. I just have to check with my wife. I have to check with my husband, my accountant, my business manager. I might be willing to buy this house. I just need to check with someone else." And here you do what you just learned in the previous section. You acknowledge them. Here's one way to handle that. "Janet, let me ask you a question. If they agree, do we have a deal?" You just diffused their deferring to higher authority in the hot potato, and you invited them into a different conversation. And if they say, "Certainly, if they agree, then we have a deal." Here's what you want to do. "Tell you what, Janet, why don't we sign a contract and add a note to the effect of pending approval of?" Well, now you're going to find out if they're a real player, if they're valid or not. If they say, no, I can't do that," you ask, "Why not?" They may really be concerned about even that level of commitment, or they may be on the way out the door. Anyway, you want to find out. They may also say yes if they feel they have enough wiggle room to say to themselves, "I'm out of here," because they didn't approve it. So you write the contract with a note, "Subject to approval of so-and-so and by such and such a date." Have you closed the deal? Of course not. But you're one step closer. And your next step is to get to talk with that third person. And the conversation is very simple. "Janet, if your husband is willing to do this, all it needs is your approval, and you've already given that." And as you learned in the segment about deferring to higher authority, you ask, "Hey, when can the three of us talk about it?" This is one kind of hot potato. And then there's the classic story about the young man pacing the floor at 4 a.m, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Finally, the pacing wakes up his wife, and she asks, "Honey, what's wrong?" "Alice, you know that note, the $30,000 we owe to Fred? Well, it's due tomorrow, and I can't pay it." "So?" asks Alice. "What do you mean, so?" he asks. "Not only is he our banker, he's our best friend, and I don't have the money. I can't pay it." Alice picks up the phone, calls Fred, wakes him up at 4 a.m, wakes him out of a sound sleep, and says, "Jonathan, this is Alice. You know the note we owe you that's due tomorrow? Well, we can't pay it." "Good night," her husband screams. "What'd you do that for? Why'd you do that?" She responds, "Well, now it's his problem. Now you can go back to sleep." Don't take on someone else's problems. Someone I know was in a dilemma. She wanted to fire one of her staff because, well, the staff person was really inept. Now, she knew the staff person was marginal in her finances. Losing her job would be a financial hardship or a wonderful gift, depending on your perspective. She was so conflicted. She was taking on that person's issues or a hot potato. She was taking him on as her own. The ultimate decision had to be to terminate the employment of the incompetent employee. Actually, everyone wins in this scenario. The employee is released to find a position where she can perform. The employer no longer has to deal with the aggravation of redoing the employee's work. And she can now replace that person with someone who is a better fit. Don't take on anyone else's hot potato or problem. You got enough of your own. You don't need someone else's. Using some of the examples I've spoken about so far, such as someone making you an offer and saying to you, "Hey, that's all I've got. Can we do the deal?" True or not, they are attempting to make their problem your problem. You can always accept their problem, of course, that they don't have any more money, and take it on as your own and make the sale for less than you desire. Or you can say something like, "Well, I appreciate that's all you've got. However, the price is the price." They'll either come up with the rest or walk away. Either way, it's fine. You have not taken on someone else's problem. If you're a realtor and you're selling a house and a client says, "My maximum is $350,000. $350,000. Great. So shall I not bother to show you a $400,000 house, even though it meets your needs perfectly? See, if you take on their limit of $350,000, you see, if you take on their problem, their hot potato of $350,000 max, that's all you're going to show them. Now, that may be very real. They may not have another nickel to their name, but you want to find out. If I show you a house that's a little bit more expensive but meets your ideal needs, should I show it to you or show that to someone else? Don't take on their hot potato. So just remember, hot potato. Now you can go to a picnic. In the next segment, I'll talk about which offer never to accept. In the next segment, which is on the next CD, I'll talk about which offer never to accept.